Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
He's here. He's laughing. That is good. It's good to see you in good spirits. Father Brian D'Arcy, folks, he's been a voice of compassion, challenge and change from the pulpit, from the pages of the Sunday World. That's how different he was. On air with Terry Wogan every Monday to 8 million people in Britain and on BBC Radio Ulster, where he's still broadcasting away. He's a very proud Ulsterman. He's ministered to musicians. He was involved even as a mediator in a kidnap case. He's done everything. He stood up to church authorities with the collar on and spoken bravely about his own experiences of abuse. From Belinalec to broadcasting legend, Father Brian D'Arcy, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Oliver. That's far too much out here. couldn't live up to that.
Are you no good at taking compliments?
I'm very poor at taking compliments. And I'm very good at giving compliments. But I suppose it's part of the thing, residue from abuse.
It's
part of that.
You're broken inside.
You just don't see yourself as being useful or good or helpful or anything like that. So it is part of that, and you're quick to spot it. I try to work on it, to make sure that all you have to say after getting a compliment is, "Well, thank you very much." And that's it, just take the compliment,
Well, I hope you believe it, because people mean it when they say it to you. And we're going to talk about this award. But first of all, you turned 80 this year. And I like to hear when someone who's 80 says, you're working on that, because you never stop working on yourself, no matter what the milestone is.
No, you can't. No, and I don't think of myself as 80 anyway, for a start. I worked it out in my head, what is wrong with me. I'm 80 degrees Fahrenheit, which is only 27 Celsius.
It's a good age.
Inside of me, I'm only 27. maybe it agreed to be 30, all right.
Listen, get used to the compliments, because we are delighted to announce you're going to be inducted into the IMRO Hall of Fame. This is an important thing in broadcasting circles, because the annual radio awards, they're national, north and south. Mm. That ceremony is this Friday in Kilkenny, as it always is. Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I'm really honoured to do it. I know that. Never thought I was in that category, because I really was never a full-time broadcaster. I was somebody who broadcast as well as doing my own job. So I never thought of myself as a full-time broadcaster. And I was actually quite shocked that I was never even thought of myself as being in it. When you look at all the other ones that have received it.
And Gay Byrne, Marion Finucane, Jerry Ryan, Larry Gogan, Joe Duffy, Ray Darcy, I think was only last year, Mary Wilson recently as well. Father Brian D'Arcy.
And I just couldn't get out of it. And a national one too, it's North and South, which is a nice thing. And I'm very delighted that it's doing it. I hope I'll do it justice. And I have to make a speech later on. I'm doing it on my own, so
that'd be no bother to
you. It'd be sincere anyway. That's I've always seen, when you shouldn't be saying to somebody at a wedding and the father of the bride is saying, "Oh, you're used to this. What am I going to do?" And I'd say, "Just be yourself, and nothing will go wrong." and that is it, it's still the same as when you're even talking and preaching and all the rest of it. I used to teach homiletics in the Catholic Communications Institute way back 50 years ago. I was in terribly nervous. I still am a very nervous preacher. I would never go out without knowing what I was going to say and preach it, because I think the Word of God is too precious to even chance your arm in it.
You can't fake it.
It's too precious a thing. You can do terrible damage to somebody by saying something wrong that might hurt people, or send people back, or might think they're bad or something like that. So I always try to work hard on making have a positive message on it.
You're always yourself, and I've been dipping into the archives and I'm listening. You sound exactly the same 50 years ago, because that's how long your broadcasting career has been, as you do now. But by the way, the other inductees this year, because there's a very small pool of people who get on the IMRO Hall of Fame.
Small.
John Bowman.
Marvellous man. Sunday morning wouldn't be the same without him.
And another radio veteran, Scott Williams. So there's the three of you on Friday.
It's a blessed trinity of that, all right, isn't it?
Do you remember your first time on air?
I do. I do very well. It was 1965. I was a student, a very young student. Mm. And at that time there was Catholic Communications Institute had a training centre up at Booterstown where there was a full studio television and people came from all over the world to be trained in it.
Yeah.
It was a big thing. And there was a radio programme each Friday night called Network that was made there and broadcast on RTE about 9:30, I think, on a Friday night. And it was a very good current affairs religious programme. But at that stage, Pat O'Hearn was the producer of it, and he got to know that I was interested in music, and it was a great time for social commentary music, like Simon and Garfunkel, Gordon Lightfoot, Pete Seeger, Chris Gustafson. I mean, it was a glorious time for that.
Bob Dylan in the 60s, but,
and
yeah.
Most and certainly Bob Dylan.
And you were reviewing the music?
And I was reviewing the music.
That's what you were doing?
That's what I was doing. I used to go out and do it for him, and he taught me a lot about script writing, keep it short, keep it simple, and let the music do the talking.
Huge fan of music, always.
Always, always, and still am to this day. I don't know what I would do without music. And music, you see, is one of those things, Oliver. Art in general, but music in particular, it touches a part of your life and a part of your soul, and it expresses things that you don't even know is there in yourself. I mean, a good song, a good example of it that people will recognise is if people are grieving and they hear a song that means something or meant something to the person who died, instantly you will just dissolve in it, because the music has that capacity to unleash the thoughts that you didn't let yourself think.
And it's speaking to the ancestral brain or something isn't it? We'll have a listen to one of your broadcasts. This was actually on television. I think it's 1977, so that'll be 48 years ago. Ryark was the name of the show.
Oh,
and
yes,
you were doing your music thing. You were profiling stars. You were a working priest now at this stage.
I was.
65-year student. You're not a fully
65
ordained.
Was a student and was ordained in 69.
You're profiling an unknown upcoming young musician called Rory Gallagher, and then you talk about the man from Mullingar.
Mr. Joe Dolan is an Irishman who has become a major star in almost every country in the world. Without moving his base from his native Mullingar, he has had 10 million selling records worldwide. Joe Dolan is a household name among young people from Brazil to Borneo. After 10 years in the business, he can afford to lead the good life and enjoy the trappings of success.
I think somebody is praying for me up there.
There are a lot of people who have made a lot of money out of you. Do you ever feel you've been used or exploited?
No. I don't think I've been ever used. I got a reasonably clever outfit behind me, like, you know, that looks after all my interests and everything like that. If anybody's made money out of it, well, the only people who have made anything out of it are people who deserve to have done so, like the songwriters, the record people, anybody like that. Like, anybody who's put something into it is entitled to take something back out of it.
But you've never been exploited?
I've never been exploited.
I like how you asked a clever question there, didn't you? Entertainers often do get exploited.
Well, you see, it was a big,
cared about
a big thing at that time, particularly because you had fellas like Leo Sayre and all of those guys at that time whom I knew quite well, very well. And they were being exploited left, right and centre, and there were court cases coming up, and Gilbert O'Sullivan, as you remember, was fighting very strongly to get back his own stuff, and it was a big thing across the world. And
you became huge friends with all these big stars.
Yeah, I became friendly with them all. Yes, I did, thank God. I enjoyed them, and they knew that I was out to help them, and it would still be the same. You'd be out to help people.
That was the difference, wasn't it, of having being a priest, maybe doing this job?
It probably was. Well, you see, some of the time was, you know, priests could exploit people too, a lot of the time. And that was, I used to say that about the show bands. The priests used to condemn them and condemn me for being associated with such riffraff as the show bands. Yeah. And that was the language they used. But then, as soon as they needed a church built, it was the show bands that went to look to raise money for it and do charity shows, you know what I mean? So there was that bit of double think about the thing as well. And I never liked that, you know. A man's talent, if he wants to donate his talent, that's wonderful. But if he can't donate his talent. There's the old story about Joe Dolan and Ben. You know that old story about Joe and Ben. There was a one stage in Joe's life where he went off to England and met and lost a bit of fan base here, and he was coming back, and he had a nice gig up in the middle of the country on a Wednesday night, and it was £500, you see, but not enough people came in to pay the £500 on that particular occasion. So the priest went and said to Ben, "Ben, do you know what it is?" He said, maybe you'd take 300 and leave a few bob for the parish when you're at it." And Ben says to him, "Father, I'll tell you what he'll do." He says, "Give me the 500 and at least one of us will go home happy."
That's the way to do business.
That's the way to do business, exactly.
Tell us about your biggest hit, because that undoubtedly was Pause for Thought. Isn't that what it was called on Terry Wogan's show?
Still is. Yeah.
Every Monday.
Yeah, I was doing that. I'm doing that 35 years, actually. Started in January 1990 when I changed from Mount Argus to live in the north. As soon as I went into the north, BBC came on to me and asked me would I... It was hard enough to get... They have a great policy in BBC that every religion, you know, and every group of religious people get a fair shot at it.
Yeah.
So they were having difficulty getting an Irish priest. and so
can you believe it?
Can you believe it? Exactly. Broadcast. And so when I went up there, they asked me would I do it, and I went on. It was a fellow, Derek Jemison was the first guy I started with, and the difficulty with Derek Jemison was if I mentioned God, he thought I was talking about him, you know. You know, so Derek, no matter what I said, Derek had a contradiction. Gives you this thing. But got on well with him for a while. That was Brian Hayes for another while. And Brian just didn't want anybody in the studio with him. He was a very sincere guy, but he had a bank of speakers and he didn't want to see anybody do anything. Then I was with Sarah Kennedy for a while, and then Terry came back on, and of course I'd known Terry from over here, and we got on like a house and fire. So it was 18 years with Terry, and 9 with Chris Evans, and they were marvellous people, you know. They wanted a little bit of a thought provoking thing in their programme, and they welcomed it and made you feel at home, and you know
it was a great commitment on their part.
Huge, and still going. I don't them as often, but I've done a few this year.
And what people may not have realised listening to you all across Britain and the world indeed was that you were sitting in your bedroom in Fermanagh.
I was sitting in my bedroom in Fermanagh, an ISDN line. In fact, Mr. Wogan used to say, "Now we'll hop across the Irish Sea to a man who won't even get out of bed to broadcast."
He made a documentary for TV and he went to this room with you for the first time.
He didn't.
And this was part of a 2011 BBC series called Terry Wogan's Ireland. Let's have a listen.
This is my room.
Your simple bedroom.
My simple bedroom.
And also, have you got here?
And this is a lovely red light which should remind you of something.
Yeah.
For 20 years on Pause for Thought, usually on a Monday morning, I joined you, so this little red light was burning outside the door.
It's of no religious significance whatsoever.
Only that Terry Wogan broadcast at the other end. And I sat down here, put on my headphones, and spoke to the nation, to 8 million people from this little desk, and then went back to bed.
I got up at 20 past five every morning. Traipsed into London, into Broadcasting House. Got
out of the bed,
in the pajamas.
Turned around into the pyjamas and said, "Good morning, Terry."
You were the original work from home.
Work from home. Now before, there was one morning I was doing a Pause for Thought there was a brother in the monastery with me who had peacocks. And I was in the middle of this serious enough broadcast when the peacocks started crowing. And I'm saying to myself, "Please God, Terry, don't let that myself." I was saying, "I hope he's not hearing that." And then he stopped. He says, Brian, excuse me, stop. Before you continue, would you kindly take your foot off the baby's head?"
He was a one-off.
Oh, wow, he was
brilliant.
Oh,
my gosh, you were
such
a very good
lovely
team.
Man, lovely man.
I saw the clip of it on YouTube. It was a humble little room. That is legitimately where you lived in those days. St. Gabriel's Retreat.
That's where I still live.
You're still there. And then you went to Dublin for a while, did you, after that, and then come back again? Or were you always there?
I was 25 years in Mount Argus in Dublin. I was parish priest and director of Mount Argus in Dublin. And then it was when I re-roofed the place. I made a fatal mistake. I re-roofed the place and built it up and took the dry rot out of it and raised £2.5 million. And the problem was I paid for it, so it was no longer needed. So they changed me up to the skin where I'd start all over again and do the same thing.
Victim of success.
And it was the victim of success, is right. And then I was there, excuse me, and then I went to Crossgar in County Down. And then I came back to Enniskillen, and then I went back to Crossgar, and now I'm back to Enniskillen.
So you're now on the shores of Lough Erne.
Shores of Lough Erne, a beautiful place. I just love it. And I love it because not every man's a prophet in his own land, but I like the people, and I spend my time going around visiting the hospitals and visiting the sick, and I do things that that priests used to do and don't have the time to do anymore, and I just keep doing that. And try, the other thing is I try to have a positive sermon, not be telling people they're bad, but telling people to find out how good you are. Mm-hmm. Try and discover how good you are within yourself, and it'll be marvellous.
You've always been your authentic.
Great privilege to be able to do that.
Yeah, and you've been your authentic self. Sometimes wasn't always good for your career. Tell us, 1995, there's a Late Late Show. This is in the middle of a very fraught period, isn't it, where revelations are emerging.
Yes, it was just after Brendan Smith and all of that, and the church was in a mess. And there was, every day you got up, there was new revelations in it. And it was difficult for me because I'd never said that I had been abused.
Is it Cardinal Cathal Daly?
Cathal Daly, yes.
It's a Late Late Show dedicated to this whole topic, and he's the main guest.
He's the main guest.
You're in the audience.
I was in the audience, and I'll tell you why in a minute if you want. So what happened was, I actually came in here, I used to do the gig guide on 2FM with Alan Corcoran, and I come down a Friday evening, go in here and do a gig guide and for Saturday, a gig guide for Sunday, and leave them there. And I was here and went over for a cup of tea to the dining room in the middle of the complex here. And in that, John Masterson was the producer of the Late Late that night, and he says, "Oh, geez, Brian, Kay is looking for you. Do you want to come on this programme? What are you talking about?" And I said, then he explained. I said, "No, sir, I can't." I said, I've recorded a programme with Gerry Kelly and UTV, which is going out next week, and I don't want to. But he said, "Well, if he knows you're here and he wants you in." And
you couldn't say no, and you find yourself in the audience. What is it about Cardinal Daly's appearance or what he's saying that kind of upsets you? That made you speak out from the audience.
It was really the whole thing. It was badly designed from a point of view, because we had the first half of the show in which everybody was saying what was wrong with the place and what we needed to do. And everybody was speaking, including myself, because Gay came to me in the audience to speak very, very honestly about it. And then all of a sudden there's a break, and we discover that Cardinal Daly has been upstairs listening to the whole thing, writing his notes, and coming in now at the second half of the show and telling us that we're all wrong.
And he's defending the church staunchly at a time when revelations are building.
And it's just, it wasn't facing the facts, you know.
Here's a clip. This is 1995, and I'm not sure if you've heard this maybe since then, 30 years ago.
How come, Brian, sorry. Cardinal, how come there are so many good priests, so many good lay people, and nobody believes that they are seen as good, nobody believes that anything will be done? What's the problem in communication there? Because most people looking at this tonight will say, look, that was a talk shop, and it was nice to have a talk shop, but we will go to Mass on Sunday, and next year our church will parish will be the same. So how are we breaking that down? Why can't we do something to give people, in a practical level, the kind of hope and encouragement that you speak so eloquently about?
I wish I had some members of my own pastoral council here, or some of my own clergy here with me, to talk about the things that they are doing. I think that some of us have been very hard on the clergy. There are some of them working very, very hard.
Yeah, I agree.
Along the lines that you desire, and getting there too.
But I don't think so, Cardinal. I don't think that's fair. I don't think what you've said is fair, Cardinal Daly. And you and I have had arguments many times before, and I hope we'll have them again in a friendly sort of way. But Cardinal Daly, what I'm trying to say is that I know there are good priests holding the church together, and I know that there are good people working together, and I know there's a knot of goodness, but at the end of the day, the church is perceived as heavy-handed and out of date and lacking in compassion. Now, why is that? And we can't dismiss it just because Putin.
Your boss, very, very powerful figure, he was furious with you.
Oh, he was absolutely furious. Absolutely furious with me. But I mean, it was a moment that I don't know where it came out of in me. But I'd gone to meetings for so long. And every meeting of a group of clerics would end, well, we've listened to you. We've heard you. We've heard you. We've heard you. Was this great phrase, and we will make sure things are changed. And
it was kind of shut up, really.
It was just shut up, and nothing. And I just that just blew a fuse with me, and I just said, "We can't do that." So that's really what I was saying to him. You know, but there's a long story after
it
that.
Sound, what you're saying sounds like perfectly normal, logical stuff now, but at the time that was quite incendiary. What you're saying, particularly as a priest. Were there consequences for you?
You had surely consequences for me, very strong consequences. I mean, I wasn't welcome to do weddings or funerals in many parishes throughout the country. And I was an outcast.
Were the people deciding that, or were the clergy?
The clergy, or the clergy. Yeah, okay. It was the clergy.
You were blocked from doing your job.
Yeah, well, I was, even though when I would talk to them, they would agree with what I was saying, but I shouldn't have said it publicly. And I just
keep it in-house. Yeah.
Which is precisely what was wrong.
That was the point you're
making. That was the point I was making. You know, that's how abuse thrives, when nobody talks about it.
How are you now with the story of your own abuse? I know you started saying it doesn't go away, and it stops you even accepting compliments. But you're 80 years of age now. Mm. Will you reach a moment where... You'd
like to reach a moment. You can manage it. I manage it well. It doesn't affect my life other than stupid things like not taking a compliment, you know. But the big thing about it is people know that, and there wouldn't be a week there wouldn't be somebody coming from some part of the country to reveal their abuse for the first time. And, you know, there's an undercurrent of abuse in this country that has never been faced. And I don't think we've even touched the beginning of it at all, to be honest with you. Because the first thing is, I would say about maybe 20% of the people who are abused can admit it to themselves.
Only that.
Maybe. Only that. Only that. And the second thing is that, you know, it's when in relationships and you realise if you've been abused, grandmothers come in to say they were abused and were never able to say it. And they're only able to say it now to somebody that they know is safe to say it to. Grandfathers, and mothers. Because it takes you so long, it just destroys your ability to have an opinion about yourself, to self-worth. Self-worth is the most important part of healthy living. And if you haven't got a self-worth, you can act in a very dysfunctional way. And the thing that that people who haven't been abused never understand is that if your innocence has been taken at such a young age, and you have been blamed for what you weren't responsible for, and so your psychology about sexuality, your own sexuality, your own self-worth, your own ability to do things just disappears, and the rest of your life you can either face it and try to manage it, or you can try to drown it in dysfunctional activity. And both of those, people choose to do one or other of those. But the healthy thing is to try and face it and manage it and talk about it and understand it and try and understand yourself. And the word compassion is the biggest word in the dictionary at the moment. You know, genuine compassion, that you're able to have compassion for yourself. Not to be too preachy, but as the Lord said, you love the Lord your God with all your heart, your neighbour as yourself. Three loves. The hardest love is the one to love yourself. And you can love nobody else unless you love yourself.
So the message is, admit it to yourself, first of all.
Admit it to yourself. admit it to yourself and admit
to
the damage
the
that was done.
Again.
And the second thing is to say,
because you said you never found your childhood again.
No,
1956.
Yes. And I never found my childhood again. And you know, and as I often know that now, and I have to be careful about that, you know, because you can. One of the things is your development can freeze at the time you were abused, and that's a very common thing. And so you
that's
can
devastating.
Devastating. Your development freezes there, and you act in a childish way afterwards if you're not careful.
But look at what you've achieved in your life. It's extraordinary. With that damage and the good that you've done for people, and I hope you believe it.
I think that the one thing that I can honestly say now was that because of the abuse to me and having the privilege of being able to deal with it in a positive way eventually, because of that, I think I can speak honestly to anybody about what it's like to be abused, and I will take no nonsense from anybody else because I know what it was like.
Yeah. You're at 80 years of age. Most of the people working and in power across the world are around that age. So
my time has come.
Your time is now. What is next for you? What are your plans?
Well, I often say, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans.
I love that one.
So,
can I give you some lovely messages, by the way?
Sure, Oliver. Thank you. It's been a lovely talk. I really
Father Brian's a true talk. Christian in the real sense. I lay sleeping with my dying father in the Éireann Hospital, Enniskillen. Father Brian used to quietly creep in at night when no one would see him to pray with Dad, as he did with all who were dying. He explained to me later he felt privileged to spend time with someone who was so close to being with God. A good man. Thank you, Father Brian. That's from Emer. And that's, again, breaking the rules to do something good. And pre-COVID, he very kindly went out of his way, met my mother in Waterstones at Cork, gave her over an hour of his time. She was an avid fan, always read his articles in the Sunday World, loved his open and honest opinion. She has since passed away. However, what a kind and nice thing to do, giving love. It trumps everything, says Maria.
Well, that's true, it is.
Enjoy the event this Friday in your black tie. I hope.
I have the short... Black shirt.
Black shirt.
I have to borrow a white tie from you, I think.
Father Brian D'Arcy, look after yourself.
Been a privilege. Thank you very much.
Back with music
Email
after this.
Oliver@rte.ie.